Mesrick is the popular author of such bestsellers as The Accidental Billionaires, which was adapted into the Academy Award-winning film The Social Network, and Bringing Down the House, the basis for the hit movie 21. Ben graduated magna cum laude from Harvard and still resides in Boston. Ben is known for creating highly addictive nonfiction, chronicling stories of people on the edge of impossibility, ethics, and morality. Today, Ben stops by to speak about his new title, Once Upon a Time in Russia, The Rise of the Oligarchs, a true story of ambition, wealth, betrayal, and murder. Ben, it's great to have you back with us on The Book Report.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
How in the world did you hit upon the story for Once Upon a Time in Russia?
Yeah, you know, I never set out to write about Russia. I know very little about Russia normally. But I got a phone call from Brett Ratner, who is the director. He did the Rush Hour movies. He did Tower Heist and Family Man, I think it was. Anyways, he called me up and said, there's these guys in London I want you to meet. They want to tell you a story. So I flew to London. And when I got there, I went to this bar, and there was all this security outside, a lot of big guys with guns. And I went inside, and there was this Russian oligarch there. And he just started telling me this story, and it was just incredible. But my first response was, no way. I don't want to do this. This seems very intense and scary. But as I heard the story, I got really sucked into it and decided to write it.
Well, I hope you were wearing a bulletproof vest and brought your own liquids to drink.
Yeah, you know, you hear all these stories about polonium poisoning, and it's all in the book. And
right.
How is the people sort of lined up? But in general, this was really a thriller. You know, it's a true-life thriller about these oligarchs who made this incredible fortune in the 90s and were kind of responsible for creating Putin. And then it's very James Bondy, I think. I just loved writing it.
I'm interested in how the term oligarchs became associated with this group of Russian billionaires.
Well, it really was a small number of people. At one point in time, it was seven men who controlled 50% of Russia's GDP, which is a spectacular number when you think about it. You talk about the 1% in our country. In Russia, it was literally seven guys. These were outsiders. These were people from nowhere. Most of them were Jewish in a very anti-Semitic society, so they essentially were, under communism, not allowed to have regular jobs. They weren't going to regular schools. And when suddenly the country became capitalist overnight, these were the guys who were in the right position. They were essentially black marketeers, people who kind of knew how to be businessmen, and they worked their way in, and they became billionaires almost overnight.
Tell us a little about Boris Berezovsky.
Boris Berezovsky. So he's the main character of the story. He was a mathematician who was Jewish, wasn't allowed to go to regular schools, and basically when communism fell, he became a car salesman. He started selling cars, and he figured out a way to make an enormous fortune moving cars across the country. They were made around Siberia, and by the time he sold them in Moscow, he was paying pennies on the dollar for them. And he made a fortune doing that, but then in 1994, he was nearly murdered. His car was blown up, his driver was decapitated, and he decided at that point that the only way to stay alive in business in Russia was to involve yourself in politics. So he wormed his way into the Kremlin and became known as the godfather of the Kremlin. And he became this very powerful oligarch. He essentially was the first real oligarch. And that's kind of where my story starts.
And tell us about Roman Abramovich.
So Roman Abramovich was his protege. Roman Abramovich was a 26-year-old guy from Siberia who made children's toys. He was making rubber ducks and you know, dolls. And he met Berezovsky on a yacht in the Caribbean. And he said, I want to, you know, create an oil company. He pitched the idea of putting together these three things, an oil refinery, an oil trading center, and another oil plant. And together, him and Berezovsky privatized this oil company that became the second largest oil company, which was eventually worth $13 billion. They did it with almost nothing up front, and it was using Berezovsky's connections in the Kremlin and Abramovich's connections in Siberia. They were able to do this. And it was almost overnight that Abramovich became sort of the silent oligarch. Nobody really knew anything about it, and he was very secretive, and Berezovsky was kind of the loud, brash one. And together they built this company until Berezovsky, you know, had a falling out with Putin, and that's where it all kind of ended.
What exactly is Kreshya?
So Kreshya is this concept, it's a very uniquely Russian concept, of a roof. The idea is, in Russia, a building is held up by the roof, not the foundation. You need a protector. It comes from the mafia. you'd always have sort of a don or someone above you in the mafia who protected you. And in business in Russia, you needed a Krisha. Berezovsky was Abramovich's Krisha, and Boris Yeltsin, who was the president of the country, was Boris Berezovsky's Krisha. So everyone kind of needs a roof. It's not sort of, there's no contracts, there's no forms, there's no shares in a company. It really is just one guy protects the other guy. And Abramovich sort of made this deal with Berezovsky that he would be his roof. And in return, whatever Berezovsky asked for, Abramovich had to provide. So Berezovsky would say, I need $3 million. And they would literally fill suitcases with $3 million in cash and just carry it over to his house and drop it off. So there was all this kind of cash flowing one way for most of their company.
We're speaking with Ben Mezrich on The Book Report. Talk about loans for shares and its impact on the Russian economy.
Sure. So what happened was communism fell, but there was always this threat that communism would come back. And when Yeltsin was in power, he was terrified that he was going to always lose the next election to communism. So he came up with this idea that if we can quickly privatize the whole country, if we can give all resources away to private businessmen almost overnight, it will make it impossible for communism to come back. So it was actually for good reasons that they did this, but they created this loans for shares system where they essentially allowed people to take loans out on companies without really putting any money up in return for shares in the company they would soon own. So if you were a guy who was becoming an oligarch, you would essentially be able to buy an oil company for nothing. You would get loaned the money in return for shares in the company. So it was really just a connections game, and it led to cronyism. It led to this whole idea that if you knew Yeltsin, if you were part of his family, if you were in cahoots with the Kremlin, you could easily get a hold of a major company.
Tell us more about the unusual transition from Yeltsin to Putin.
Yeah, well, what happened was these oligarchs who were essentially running the country, it was obvious that Yeltsin was dying. You know, he was always sick. He was always drunk. And he was falling apart, and they knew they needed to replace him with somebody, and they wanted to find someone that they could control. They called the idea, they wanted a cog, someone who was just part of the machine, and they found this low-level KGB agent, Vladimir Putin. He was working for the mayor of St. Petersburg. Boris Berezovsky knew him because Berezovsky had tried to set up a car dealership in St. Petersburg and had met this KGB agent there, and they essentially handpicked Putin. And they first placed him as the head of the FSB, which was what the KGB had become. Then he became prime minister. And then Yeltsin was fearing that he was going to lose the election in 2000 at the millennium. So what he did is that on New Year's Eve, he stepped down in this very shocking speech. He basically went in front of the Russian people and said, I'm stepping down and I'm handing the country over to my acting president, Vladimir Putin. And at that point, Putin basically was entrenched and became president almost overnight.
You know, it's so easy for us to poke fun at Putin, his shirtless tough guy image. But after reading Once Upon a Time in Russia, you see he's a guy who stops at nothing, employs any tactic to achieve his ends. Can the West deal with someone who is that ruthless?
Well, I think people underestimate Putin all the time. They think he's someone that is either going to respond well to sort of sanctions, they're going to force the oligarchs to take Putin down. But the reality is it's Putin is the most powerful man in that country, and he's incredibly popular. The Russian people love Putin. So they think, the Russian people believe, all of these sanctions are just the evil West putting pressure on their country, and it just entrenches Putin. It makes him stronger. The oligarchs all work for Putin now. In my book, there's the opening scene, and this really happened. Right after Putin was elected, he invited all of the oligarchs to Stalin's old house. And he sat them down at a table, and this is the place where you can see bullet holes in the walls where people were lined up and shot. And he said to the oligarchs, you've all made a lot of money, you've all done really well, but from here on out, you stay out of my way. And essentially, that was the moment that Putin took over the country for real. He's the top of the pyramid. The oligarchs can't force Putin out. It's the other way around. Putin can get rid of the oligarchs whenever he wants. He can jail them or have them killed or take their money away. So really, he's an incredibly powerful person. You have to find a way to work with him. There's no way to sort of force him. There's not going to be a revolution in Russia. The opposition is very small, very weak compared to Putin. He's a very, very strong leader. And so you have to find a way to work with him. And, you know, he doesn't want war. He really wants Russia to be incredibly powerful and accepted and respected by the West. I think those are his goals. I mean, he wants the Soviet Union back, but he wants the world to understand that Russia is powerful and to take its place as the most powerful country or the second most powerful country. And so I think you have to deal with that psychology when you're dealing with him.
What are your final thoughts about Once Upon a Time in Russia?
Well, I will say it was an incredible, you know, experience writing this book. It was a little terrifying. We had one meeting where I was sitting with Brett Ratner at his restaurant with his oligarch, and Brett turned to the guy and goes, "Are we going to get killed for writing this?" The oligarch goes, "You watch too many movies."
Uh-huh.
And so Brett said, "Well, what if we say the wrong thing?" And he said, "Don't say the wrong thing."
Uh-huh.
So I feel like, no, I wrote it like a thriller. I think it reads like a thriller. And in the end, I hope people get a new understanding of who these oligarchs were and, you know, sort of ruthlessness, but ambition that led them to where they are.
Well, I know that after reading this book, I'm more terrified of Putin than I had been before. That's a definite.
Yeah, it's fascinating. But, you know, he's not the bad guy in this story. That's what's interesting about it. In the scope of sort of the oligarch story, Putin took over and decided, I'm going to make this country good for Russia. That was his goal. And so by chasing many of the oligarchs out of Russia, by choosing which ones to stay, he was attempting to take the resources and give it back in a way to the Russian people. So in the scope of the story, he's not really the bad guy, but he is ruthless.
All the hits aside and all the murders. Okay,
I mean, you have to accept that there's going to be a lot of murders in this situation.
Right.
You have to equate it to the Wild West in America.
Right.
You know, back in the 1800s, we were shooting each other, too. And that's the way they look at it.
So do you have a kernel for a new book percolating in your brain?
I am. I'm working on a new book and a movie at the same time. Once Upon a Time in Russia is going to be a big movie.
Oh.
Sell it to Warner's, and Ratner's producing it. And then I have another project called The 37th Parallel, which is a book and movie for next summer. And it's about a guy in Colorado who essentially uncovered something very strange in the world of UFOs. But I don't want to give too much of it away.
All right.
But it's called The 37th Parallel.
Oh, well, we'll be looking forward to it, Ben. Thanks again for a fabulously fascinating book, and thanks for stopping by.
Oh, I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
All righty. Bye.
Bye-bye.